The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, so we're going to get started. Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Steve Leidick. I teach constitutional law occasionally at federal courts. And this is our brown bag lunchtime discussion on the Defense of Marriage Act and the Holder Letter. Hopefully you guys have gotten the handouts, some of which Professor Polycoff will describe to you, one of which is the Holder Letter itself. So last week, the Attorney General of the United States sent a letter to Speaker Boehner advising him that the executive branch has decided it can no longer defend in two cases currently pending in the Second Circuit the constitutionality of certain provisions of the Defense of Marriage Act. And what's fascinating about the letter, as much as the Attorney General's suggestion that the government will not defend the statute, is why. Specifically that the Attorney General now believes that at least Section 3 of DOMA, if not all discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, should be subjected to heightened scrutiny as opposed to rational basis review. Not to get too technical, but this is, of course, a momentous distinction in constitutional law. Rational basis laws come to the courts with a presumption of constitutionality. They will only be struck down if they are shown to be irrational, arbitrary, or in some other cases, perhaps otherwise flawed. Heightened scrutiny, of course, totally inverts that. And indeed, I dare say it would be very difficult for most governmental discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation to survive heightened scrutiny. So we thought what we would do is get together to talk about the Holder Letter. You know, it's sort of unusual for us, but hopefully it will become more of a trend where we take advantage of the fact that we have interested students, interested faculty, and don't always have to feed you to get you to come listen to us. And so that's why
we accept free food.
That's right. So anyway, I'm going to sort of largely step out of the way in a second, but let me just, before I do that, thank Mary Clark and the Law and Government Program for sponsoring today's discussion and for organizing it. And indeed, let me also say, I hope this becomes a model of our ability at WCL to have last-minute, as they happen, fresh-from-class discussions of key issues. So here's our format. I'm going to briefly introduce our four speakers today. They're each going to talk for somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes, Professor Marcus. And then we're going to sort of talk amongst ourselves and open it up to you. So this is as much of a discussion as it is us talking at you. I think my four fellow panelists need no introduction, but just in case, starting all the way on my right, only in orientation perspective, is Professor Nancy Polycoff. To her left, my right, is Professor Dan Marcus, Professor Bill Yeomans, and Professor Amanda Frost. And so with that, I will turn it over to you, Professor Polycoff.
Okay, so I'm sort of giving the substantive background about how we got DOMA taking us up to the present. So in 1993, the Hawaii Supreme Court became the first state appeals court in the country to rule that a ban on same-sex marriage was sex discrimination and under the Hawaii state constitution could only stand if the state could prove it was necessary to achieve a compelling state interest, the kind of strict scrutiny that Professor Vladeck mentioned. And even though it got sent back for a trial on that issue, so it didn't immediately say you had to let same-sex couples marry, it did cause quite a flurry of reaction, because the basic rule in family law is that a marriage that is valid where it's performed is accepted as valid in all the other states. And there is an exception, and the exception is if it violates the strong public policy of the state. That's not constitutional law, that's just plain old garden variety family law. So the what was on the horizon, which didn't come to pass for other reasons, but what was on the horizon was same-sex couples were going to be able to get married in Hawaii, and then they were going to go home to their respective states where they would demand recognition under basic principles of family law. And so states immediately started passing statutes saying they would not recognize same-sex marriages in order to essentially express their strong public policy against them. And so one of the charts I passed around was the chart on prohibitions on recognizing same-sex relationships. And if it looks very hard to follow, it's because it is all very hard to follow in this area of law. But you'll notice that quite a number of states enacted such statutes in 1995, 1996. So responding to this 1993 development, they got on the wagon quickly, trying to make a statement that they would not recognize same-sex marriages from elsewhere. So, in 1994, the Congress was taken over by Republicans. President Clinton was still in office. He was facing re-election in 1996. Shortly before the 1996 re-election, we're talking weeks, Congress sent two bills to his desk. One was the so-called welfare reform bill, which eliminated the financial safety net for poor people in this country. And the other was the Defense of Marriage Act. And Congress understood perfectly well that as a political matter, Clinton would have no choice but to sign both of these laws. And he did sign them. And this is what the Defense of Marriage Act said. It codified what all of us who know family law already knew to be the law, which is it said that states did not have to recognize same-sex marriages from other states. And that's what we call Section 2 of DOMA. And it had another substantive section, Section 3, in which it said, for federal law purposes, the only marriages that will be recognized will be marriages between a man and a woman. So this became federal law in 1996. Now, there never was marriage in Hawaii for same-sex couples because of a constitutional amendment that was passed in Hawaii. And in the subsequent years, it actually took until 2004 for any state to recognize same-sex marriages. Now, in between that period of time, there was a fair amount of litigation and legislation going on that I don't have time to talk about in detail. But one of the things that happened during that period of time was that in 2000, we got the invention of a status called civil union. And that was originally in Vermont. And that is a status that grants all the state-based rights and responsibilities of marriage to a couple who enters into a civil union in that state. There is also a term you may have heard, which is domestic partnership. This is a generic term. So when you hear somebody talk about domestic partnership, you actually have no idea what they're talking about in terms of actual legal consequences. It can mean very little, or it can mean a status like civil union that grants all the state-based consequences of marriage to couples who register. So right now we have, and I might have lost track, but the colored map that you have is of states that do grant recognition, and Hawaii became the last state just last week to grant civil unions effective January 1st of next year. I believe it will be six states that have state-based recognition through domestic partnership or civil union. Might be seven. And five that allow same-sex couples to marry, as well as the District of Columbia. So you all have heard of the famous litigation, I'm sure, Perry versus Schwarzenegger, famous because the lawyers in that case are David Boies and Ted Olson, who were on opposite sides in Bush v. Gore. This is a federal constitutional challenge from California making its way through the federal court system. This letter was about something else. It was about litigation brought originally in Massachusetts and then also in Connecticut and New York, only challenging the part of the Defense of Marriage Act that concerns federal recognition of same-sex marriages. So that is only Section 3 of DOMA. Maybe other people on the panel will talk about whether they think this letter means more than that, but explicitly, what the Department of Justice has said is we are being sued by married couples in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and other Vermont and other states. We've now got Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, New Hampshire, Iowa, and the District of Columbia that allow same-sex couples to marry. So the plaintiffs in the litigation are married same-sex couples who are completely recognized as married under their state law, but who are not recognized as married under federal law because of Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act. That is the only issue in that litigation. It's not litigation about whether it's unconstitutional across the board to deny marriage to same-sex couples. It's not about recognizing civil unions or domestic partnerships. It's simply limited to whether the federal government must recognize as married same-sex couples who are married in the states where they live. I'm going to leave it at that, but I am going to refer you to the maps that I passed around. One comes off the website for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, the other from the Human Rights Campaign, only because HRC updated its map in the last week to add Hawaii. And if it does look confusing to you, welcome to my world. Right? Just even to keep, I have to look at these maps even to keep straight what kinds of prohibitions there are, because you will see that there are states that prohibit same-sex marriage that also grant civil union status to same-sex couples. So that can be kind of confusing. I mean, it all can be kind of confusing. So if you need to use the maps as a cheat sheet to understand the law from one state to another, all of us do. And I'll leave it at that.
Great. That's it. Professor Martha.
Thank you, Steve. I'm going to talk a little about the state of federal constitutional law on equal protection and due process challenges, and because the standard of review is a critical issue in these pending cases that challenge the constitutionality of Section 3 of DOMA. I think, as Professor Polakoff said, it's a confusing array of lawsuit statutes and in the states and their interaction with the federal statute. But I think the constitutional issues are pretty similar across the board with respect to same-sex marriage. In other words, while most of the litigation in the states, as Professor Polakoff said, involves state constitutions, not federal constitutions, that's been a deliberate tactic of the challengers to the bans on same-sex marriage in the states, because they're worried about the U.S. Supreme Court. And so if they can get a decision from a state Supreme Court that a state statute violates the state constitution, which most state constitutions have equal protection clauses and due process clauses that are similar, if not identical, in many cases identical to the ones in the U.S. Constitution. If they get a decision based on the state constitution, Chief Justice Roberts and his colleagues can't get their clammy hands on it.
Just the voters of Iowa.
Yeah, just the voters can amend the state constitution. That's what happened in California after the state Supreme Court struck down the California ban on same-sex marriage. The voters, in their wisdom, amended the state constitution to tell the Supreme Court to get lost, the state. And that's what gave rise to the first major federal lawsuit challenging a state law. Okay, so what's interesting, the Justice Department's excuse for the Holder letter, which I gather has been distributed to you, and if you don't have it, there's some more copies on the front. Desk here. The excuse for changing its position on defending the law is, gee whiz, we've been defending Section 3 of DOMA in courts of appeals where the Court of Appeals has already held that only a rational basis standard applies in judging the constitutionality of the statute. And on a rational basis test, it's much easier to uphold Section 3 of DOMA than it would be under heightened scrutiny, either intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny. Now we're litigating these cases. We have to file a brief in the Second Circuit, and there, the question of the proper standard of review, the proper level of scrutiny of a statute that makes distinctions, classifications based on sexual orientation, is up for grabs. So we've had to take a hard look at that, and we've concluded that heightened scrutiny is required. And it's pretty clear, while they don't specify whether it's intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny, when they describe it, it's clear they're talking about intermediate scrutiny, the same level of scrutiny that's given by the Supreme Court to classifications based on sex, based on gender. I think in the real world, I do think that the Justice Department has been struggling with the defense of this case, because they have, as Attorney General Holder I think indicates in his letter or adverts to, while they've been defending DOMA as passing a rational basis test, that is that DOMA reflects a legitimate state interest, and which is reasonably related to the statute precludes the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages in tax laws, social security laws, and so on. They have disavowed the legitimacy of many of the state interests that have been asserted, governmental interests that have been asserted in support of state statutes banning gay marriage or in support of DOMA. And so the other thing that's changed, and I think that has had a major impact on the decision by the President and the Justice Department, and my colleagues may talk about this more, is that Congress has repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I think politically that's made it easier for the Justice Department to change its position. Okay, so what's the state of the law on the level of scrutiny applicable to classifications based on sexual orientation? We don't really know, because the Supreme Court has had two major decisions in this area, which, except for first-year students who haven't gotten to this yet, probably, you all know. One was Romer versus Evans in 1996, in which the court struck down a provision of the Colorado State Constitution that banned both the state government and any local governments in Colorado from applying their anti-discrimination laws to discrimination based on sexual orientation. And in a very interesting and some would say hard to understand opinion, Justice Kennedy for the court said that rational basis was the test, but that even under the rational basis test, the Colorado law didn't make it, the Colorado constitutional provision. And of course, at the time Romer versus Evans was decided in 1996, the court's horrible old decision in Bowers versus Hardwick, holding that it was constitutional for a state to ban homosexual sodomy, was still on the books, hadn't been overruled. Then the big step, and the one that has given a lot of encouragement to the opponents of the proponents of same-sex marriage and the opponents of DOMA, is Lawrence versus Texas, also written by Justice Kennedy, in which the court overruled Bowers versus Hardwick and held that state anti-sodomy laws were unconstitutional. The problem with Lawrence versus Texas is it says nothing about what the level of scrutiny is, and it says nothing to cast doubt explicitly on Romer's holding that it's rational basis only. And yet, when you read Justice Kennedy's opinion with his lyrical celebration of individual autonomy and sexual destiny and all this stuff, you can't help but think that this is a candidate for heightened scrutiny. Now, it's really up for grabs, and what's going to happen in the Supreme Court on this issue is very hard to predict. Because, as some people have observed in the wake of Holder's controversial letter, the Supreme Court has not been an enthusiast for heightened scrutiny, for new categories of classifications that get heightened scrutiny. There hasn't been a new one added in a long, long time. Decades, I think. And you have, even among some of the liberal justices, you have Justice Stevens was a famous opponent of the whole scheme of different levels of scrutiny, and a proponent of saying, hey, you know, they don't make any sense. Let's just look in each case at the strength of the government's interest and the seriousness of the interference with a fundamental individual right. And so it's very hard to predict how this will come out. And it's fascinating, and then I'll stop. It's fascinating that in the state cases, and as you probably know, state Supreme Courts, I don't know how many decisions there have been, but they've gone both ways, usually by 4-3 votes, not always. But I think most of the state courts, and Nancy, you should correct me if I'm wrong, have struck down bans on same-sex marriage, have done so using the rational basis test. Some have used heightened scrutiny, some, and maybe it's 50-50, I don't know. Some have said, oh yes, Romer says rational basis, but we can read between the lines of Justice Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence, and it sure doesn't sound like rational basis, and it must be heightened scrutiny. So I think that's where the Justice Department has come out here. They've devised this as a sort of clever way of changing their position on defending DOMA. And I think some of my colleagues will talk about the institutional issues raised by this remarkable about-face by the Justice Department.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Just before I turn over to Bill, I just want to add one thought also. With regard to Lawrence, one of the things that's fascinating about Lawrence is it was 6-3, and Justice O'Connor's concurrence was all about Romer. Right, O'Connor said, I can strike down the Texas law because of Romer. So the fact that Kennedy didn't join O'Connor is part of why
O'Connor didn't join Kennedy.
And Kennedy said, we have to go further than that. Right, it's part of why people are like, oh, how far did Lawrence go?
Ah, yeah,
right?
Gotcha.
But that's the question now. All right, I'm sorry, I'll shut up.
No, okay. thank you, Steve.
I can't really moderate, you know. Moderate implies moderation.
okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the decision to switch and sort of how that might have been made and what it means and why it's a fairly big deal. I think, as most of you know, the Department of Justice defends the constitutionality of federal statutes unless, as Attorney General Holder said in his confirmation hearings, there is a compelling reason not to. And the standard that's usually applied is that the department will defend a statute unless there is no reasonable argument in support of its constitutionality. As you've heard, the department decided that heightened scrutiny, not the department actually, the president decided that heightened scrutiny was the appropriate standard to review classifications based on sexual orientation, concluded that the statute wouldn't survive heightened scrutiny. The little addendum that we haven't discussed is that the Attorney General's letter also says that if courts decide that heightened scrutiny is not the appropriate standard of review, the department will take the position that it's reasonable to argue that there is a rational basis for the statute. And we can talk a little bit later on about the sort of difficult position that might leave some civil division lawyers in.
Yeah.
This switch was made. This is something that is has to be done with enormous caution, and the reasons are obvious. We could have presidents coming into office deciding they don't like this statute, that statute, deciding, well, I think it's unconstitutional, so I'm not going to defend it. The obvious thing on the horizon is the health care legislation, which many people have pointed to as the next potential victim for a Republican president. So it really is incumbent on the Department of Justice to be very convincing in its legal argument that the statute is indefensible, to make it look like it's not simply a political decision. And it seems to me that this decision is curious in a couple of ways in that regard. First of all, if you look at the letter, and especially if you look at the Attorney General's announcement of the change in position, it's all about the president. The president has decided that heightened scrutiny should apply. The president has decided that it's unconstitutional. The president has instructed me, the Attorney General, not to defend the statute. So the focus is entirely on the president, our chief political official, which seems to me to be a somewhat curious way to go about this. If what you're really trying to do is create the appearance that this is strictly a legal determination. Regardless, I think it's a particularly difficult thing because what this decision does is to plunk the president down into the middle of this hotly debated social issue, coming down on a side that is of obvious political benefit to him. And it seems to me that that probably heightens the requirement for a strong legal basis for what he's doing. Also, from the institutional perspective of the Department of Justice, it's enormously important that when the Department of Justice goes to court, it's perceived as going to court to make a legal argument. And whenever there is a high-profile change in position like this or adoption of position, it can threaten the strength of the arguments that the department is making when it goes into court. I think the curious wording bears examination by everyone and suggests that there was probably considerable debate within the administration before this decision was made, and that
maybe 2 years.
And that within the Department of Justice there may not have been unanimity, which is why the president had to instruct the Attorney General to take this position. Not that the Attorney General wasn't on board, but I'm sure that there were people in the Department of Justice who were glad to see that the president was telling them what to do. Back briefly to what the announcement actually does and the difficulties that it may present and whether it's legitimate because of this. As Professor Marcus explained, the department took the occasion of being in a circuit where there's no precedent directly on point governing the standard of review to re-examine what standard should apply and decide that heightened scrutiny was appropriate. And as I said, it also conceded that there is a rational basis for Section 3. So what the department has to be arguing as a legal matter, or has to have determined as a legal matter, is there is no reasonable argument that rational basis review is the appropriate standard. If you look through the materials, I think you'll find it doesn't actually say that. It makes the argument that heightened scrutiny is the appropriate standard, which I strongly agree with. But I think it's a little difficult, much more difficult, to make the argument that there is no reasonable argument for rational basis review, particularly when most of the circuit court precedent is on the other side, although the letter tries to distinguish that as pre-Lawrence. Otherwise unconvincing, but it's there. As Professor Marcus explained, the Supreme Court is a tough call, but I think it's safe to say, and I, I'm sorry I have to say this, but there are probably four firm votes for rational basis review. So what the department is saying is that four votes on the Supreme Court and uncertainty about where the other votes are puts us into the area where it is not reasonable to make that argument. I think that's a tough step. And I think it, particularly given that this decision, as I said, plunks down in the middle of a hotly debated social issue, it's a difficult one. Now, having said all of that, I strongly agree that DOMA is unconstitutional. And we can talk a little more about later on about what the announcement actually means. I mean, I think there is no question that it helps to have the government on your side. And I think there's no question that the government's announcement that heightened scrutiny should apply to all classifications based on sexual orientation will have implications that are much broader than simply Section 3 of DOMA. And so I think that's enormously important. I will stop. Turn it over to you.
That's Bill.
All right, so those of you who had me for civil procedure, you know that I know nothing about the substance of any law. All I care about is procedure. And even though I'm on a panel like this, and suddenly the substance seems a little interesting, but I squash that down. And in fact, the procedure is really interesting here, too. And this really just actually is an extension of Professor Yeoman's comments, because I'm going to talk about what happens when the executive branch charged with defending the constitutionality and the validity of a statute says, you know what, we can't do it. What happens next? So the first thing I wanted to point out, the first thing that happens is Professor Yeoman's, as he explained, is they have to come to that conclusion that the executive branch can't defend the constitutionality of a statute. The standard for doing so is supposed to be very high. The executive is supposed to defend, and does indeed defend, the great majority of statutes, even ones that the current president might not have liked and certainly wouldn't have signed into law, nonetheless, will usually defend them. So it's a very unusual thing to have happen, but it certainly has happened in the past. It's nowhere near unprecedented. There are a number of cases in fairly recent past, some of which you have read or will read in your con law courses, in which this same problem occurs. And you'll see Congress has actually developed a mechanism to help it deal with this problem. It's cited in the first paragraph of the Attorney General's letter. The Attorney General writes a letter to John Boehner and says, in pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 530D, I am writing to advise you of the executive branch determination that it cannot defend the constitutionality of DOMA. And that's a statute Congress passed to help it know when the executive was going to take this position so Congress could do something about it. And when the executive branch will not defend the constitutionality of a law, Congress has the capacity to step in. And to start participating in litigation as well. And this is actually pretty important because of our adversarial system. The way in which we think courts do a good job of deciding cases is that they get to hear from parties with opposing views on the question. And this can be a real problem if one of the parties concedes error and says, you know, I'm not going to continue litigating this matter. I'm going to give up and give in and agree with the person who brought this case that they're right and I'm wrong. Well, you may have studied or learned about a problem when a case becomes moot. And it sort of seems like this situation. Well, a couple things here. First is that the Obama administration has actually been careful not to moot this case in its approach to this problem. It has said, we believe that this law is unconstitutional, but it is continuing to deny the benefits that these plaintiffs are seeking based on what they claim to be their merits. So it's not as if the Obama administration is directing, I guess it would be Social Security, Nancy would know more about this, but it's not directing that the estate tax money that was taken from one of the plaintiffs be given back, because if her marriage had been recognized, she wouldn't have been taxed. And it's not directing that other types of federal benefits be given to these plaintiffs. That might moot the case. Instead, what it's saying is we're going to adhere by that policy, but not defend the constitutionality of the statute in court. And I think that's actually an important point to note, because it means the executive isn't making this constitutional determination entirely on its own and divorced from any review by another branch of government. It's actually bringing the issue squarely to the courts and saying, you, the courts, get to be the last word on this. And at that point, because there's still a lot of controversy here, what can happen and what probably will happen, based on some recent news reports, is that Congress can step in. Now, individual members of Congress are always free to file amicus briefs, and they do so fairly regularly, and a few may do so in this case. But Congress can also represent itself as an institution, or rather the Senate and the House each can. The Senate has a legal counsel, and the House has a general counsel for the House, which serves the same purpose. And those two offices can submit briefs on behalf of the entire chamber. The Senate legal counsel is established by statute, and it can only participate in cases when there's a resolution by the entire Senate empowering it to do so. As a result, it rarely participates in litigation. The House general counsel is established pursuant to House rule. Those lawyers are empowered to file briefs on behalf of the House whenever bipartisan leadership advisory group agrees that it can participate. And that includes the speaker, majority leader, minority leader. And in fact, that office even files briefs occasionally when only the speaker of the House empowers the general counsel to file a brief. So it's much easier to get the general counsel to take action in a case. And Cantor has already said, that the House will participate in this litigation. So one assumes that the general counsel will be empowered to write a brief on behalf of the House defending the constitutionality of the statute.
Great. I have two questions, but you guys go first.
I just want to add two footnotes there. One, the Congress can also hire an outside law firm to represent it, and in many cases in the past, since both the House General Counsel Office and Senate Legal Counsel Office are really tiny offices without fleets of young associates to do all the research and everything.
Yeah.
In many cases,
yes,
they have hired outside law firms to represent them. And I forget what my other point. Can I make one other?
You bet.
This is a footnote to Yeomans' talk.
That's the professor.
This is a footnote to Bill's talk. While I agree that it's quite unusual for the Justice Department, when it's doing this, to say the President told us to do this, it's not unusual for the Justice Department to consult with the President, who, whether or not you're a believer in the unitary executive theory, is the head of the executive branch and the boss of the Attorney General. And we've got a president now who was a former con law professor, so he knows as much about this stuff as Eric Holder does. So it's not unusual for the Justice Department, as Bill and I, as former Justice Department people, can tell you, to consult with the president on major issues of what position the Justice Department should take in the Supreme Court.
So, just a footnote, Dan's footnote.
A cert footnote. That's Professor Marcus.
I thought we moved the first day.
General Marcus?
He's absolutely correct, of course, that it's important for the Department of Justice and the White House to consult on these issues. And the President has the ultimate authority here. There's no question about that. I think my point was more directed at managing this change,
right.
and having the President out there as the person at whom the finger is being pointed just emphasizes that this may be driven more by politics than an actual reading of the law. Just one other thing.
Yeah.
One to Professor Frost, who mentioned that there are precedents, and there are lots of precedents. We try to make this happen rarely, but it does happen. It happens in some fairly high-profile things. And it also happens when the decision is subsequently unsuccessful in litigation. For instance, the Reagan administration refused to defend the independent counsel statute, which was upheld 7-2, I believe.
Yeah.
In Metro Broadcasting, the Bush administration Metro Broadcasting. The Bush administration refused to defend the requirement that the FCC take diversity into account in broadcast licensing, and in fact, John Roberts, who was then the acting Solicitor General, is the one who informed the Supreme Court that the administration would not be defending the statute. And so it happens, and it happens where it turns out that the legal call is rejected by the Supreme Court.
So that leaves me. I have two questions before we throw it open to your questions, and I leave it to all of you to decide who's going to answer each question. So my first question, piggybacking on that, is the suggestion that Bill, I took your remarks to suggest that the real difficulty in the Holder letter is that the standard traditionally for the Justice Department to change its position has been reasonable argument. And I guess, so my first question is there anything to the notion that that applies to the validity of the law but not the standard of review, such that a subsequent Justice Department could still think on the same standard we have to have an argument that is unreasonable, and that's why the Obama administration will defend DOMA under rational basis scrutiny, but that the standard of review doesn't require a reasonable argument for it, it's either the correct standard of review or it isn't. And so there's more play for administrations to change their view about the appropriate standard of review.
Well, maybe it just seems to me that parsing this decision, the administration seems to admit that if rational basis is the appropriate standard,
right,
then there is a reasonable basis for the argument.
Well, they don't say it in the letter. The letter says we will defend it because we have before. Right? The letter doesn't say we will defend it because
they could easily have switched that position as well.
But, yeah.
You know, and I think maybe it would have been more ingenuous to go all the way and simply say we've had an opportunity to examine our prior arguments. The reasonable basis that we've been arguing has been shrinking and shrinking as we've withdrawn one justification after another from consideration, and we've now concluded there's nothing left.
So this leads me to my second and larger question, which is, I think, the big substantive question. So Nancy, in your remarks, you suggested that this is only about Section 3 of DOMA. That Section 3 is unique because it's the only federal law that takes a particular position on marriage that everything else is happening at the state level. But here's my question. Is there any principled distinction between saying that heightened scrutiny, whether it's intermediate or strict, let's just say heightened scrutiny, applies to a federal classification based on sexual orientation versus saying that it should apply to all? In other words, if the Second Circuit were to agree with the administration, doesn't that have monstrous and mammoth implications for the Prop 8 case and for any other federal constitutional challenge to any state law discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation?
Sure. Well, I mean, if the U.S. Supreme Court does. But I would go back to what Professor Marcus said about the court being completely unwilling to add new groups to suspect classifications. And I think even though, certainly when I teach this material, there's a lot of support in a class discussion for putting sexual orientation in a classification at a level that at least gets it mid-tier scrutiny, the fact that it's been 30 years since there's been an addition of a classification to get higher scrutiny suggests that's not the direction the court's going in generally, not just for gay people, but for all sorts of other people. There's a really interesting, I don't know if you guys have seen Kenji Yoshino's new article called The New Equal Protection that's just out, you know, that basically is saying forget trying to get other groups into heightened scrutiny. That's not how things are going. And he comes up with his own set of arguments. But certainly, if the Supreme Court were to do that, that would be a matter of federal constitutional law. It would apply to everything. I think the reason why I'm satisfied to just talk about this as being Section 3 of DOMA, again, just the part that concerns whether the federal government must recognize marriages that are legal in the states between same-sex couples, is that it's been a principle of family law forever that states don't have to recognize marriages that are against their strong public policy. So most of us think Section 2 of DOMA was unnecessary because it was already the law. And I think there will be challenges to that, clearly. But it's such an established principle that I think it would get analyzed in a different kind of way.
Can I ask a question so Steve can answer? I just wonder if it makes sense as a litigation strategy, given that I think we all agree that it's fairly unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to create a new suspects or other heightened kind of classification. Does it make sense as a litigation strategy to put all your eggs in that basket and has the government made a much weaker argument than it might have
but
by
so,
doing that.
But so this goes back to your point, though, right, which is that I think the administration thought that it could not reasonably argue against the constitutionality of Section 3 if rational basis was the appropriate standard of review. And so it thought it had two choices, right? One was to do nothing and continue to defend DOMA the same way it had been defended before, and continue to argue that rational basis is the right standard and it's satisfied, or take this position. Now, there is a third possibility, right? And the third possibility is, to my mind, the heart of the Prop 8 case, which is to once and sort of forever get rid of the notion that morality is a rational basis for governmental regulation, at least in this context. Right, that's the line that the court wasn't willing to cross in Lawrence, but there's certainly language in Justice Kennedy's opinion that suggests that state laws that are based purely on prevailing conceptions of social morality are not rational per se. The problem is that I think Kennedy wasn't sure what that would undo besides the sodomy laws. And so the other possibility is, if you're not going to go the heightened scrutiny route, and if you don't think that these kinds of laws survive rational basis review, you have to attack morality as a rational basis. And that's where Scalia gets really exercised.
Let me say something, because we haven't said the substance about the rational basis argument. So the Department of Justice has defended Section 3 of DOMA as constitutional under rational basis, but these are the arguments they make. The first argument is, it'll be too hard for us, the federal government, to figure out who's married and who isn't. So let's just say nobody's married if they're a same-sex couple. Well, that's ridiculous because, for example, 10 states and the District of Columbia have common law marriage, which means you don't need a marriage license, but you do have to meet very specific criteria in order to be common law married. The federal government figures out whether people who live in those states are common law married or just living together, and it makes an enormous difference. I mean, the federal government has forever gone with whatever the state law is about who's married, no matter how different it is from any other state, they've managed to accommodate it. So it's a ridiculous argument that completely fails rational basis, but they made it anyway. And their other argument is, this is a difficult and contentious social problem, and so the federal government can let the country evolve naturally in this area, which, even though that makes sense as cocktail party conversation, doesn't seem to me to actually be rationally related to a legitimate state interest, which would be rational basis. I mean, obviously, it's a contentious social issue, and obviously, we are evolving as a country in how we deal with it, but I don't consider that a constitutional argument under rational basis or anything else. So, since they're saying they would defend it under rational basis, we don't have to guess what they would say, because that's what they said in the Gill case, the case that's in the First Circuit, where they've already filed a brief saying, rational basis, this is it, and totally refusing to defend it based on the reasons Congress passed it, which was basically how awful gay people are.
Well, and protecting the institution of marriage.
Yeah.
I put it in quote marks. Put it in square quotes.
Two things, because I'm a little sympathetic with the government not wanting to bite the bullet on saying the statute's unconstitutional under a rational basis test. I think they have a legitimate sort of, this may be sort of a long-term institutional concern of the Supreme Court, that the law on rational basis, you know, Romer was an odd case to say applying a rational basis standard at that time particularly, you had to throw out that statute. And I think the Justice Department has a view that if we're going to keep this different level of scrutiny system that the Supreme Court has set up, there have to be some real differences between the levels, or else it's just not going to work at all, and it would have far-reaching implications for the Supreme Court's whole equal protection law if we said the statute doesn't survive rational basis scrutiny. And even though I agree with you, their specific arguments on rational basis are weak. I think what's underlying, I haven't read their briefs in these cases, but I think what's underlying this argument about social change and so on is the anxiety about the Justice Department taking the thing that has always struck me as the hardest part of the case against the ban on same-sex marriage is, you know, for better or worse, we've thought about marriage for a long, long time as between a man and a woman, and it's a big deal for a court on a rational basis test to say, that's out. And it's one thing to say, and this is I think, why if the Supreme Court comes out the right way in the Trump 8 case, if it gets there.
This is getting there way sooner than that.
Yeah.
Thank God.
I think if the Supreme Court goes for this, they'll do it on intermediate scrutiny. That's my prediction. I think they will not, and that would be a much better way to do it, because this is a discrimination statute. This is, I mean, the case, I agree that they haven't, you know, I know they haven't had a new classification at heightened scrutiny in 30 years or whatever, but if there ever was a case for it, it's this one.
I think that's right. I also think we talked a bit about the politics of this. I mean, I think Jack Balkin has a post on Balkanization about this. One way to look at this is that this is not about anything other than giving cover to the courts, right? That if you look at many of the profoundly counter-majoritarian decisions in American judicial history, some political actor had done something in the months or years leading up to that decision to create safe space for the courts, right? Eisenhower created some room for Brown. And so another possibility is that this is just saying to the courts, now you have an elected official, right, the president, who's all over the letter, you know, out in front of this. And so it wouldn't be counter-majoritarian to go back on 25 years of precedent. Anyway. You guys have been patient. It's time for your questions. We've got about 10 minutes. Fire away.
So there's kind of the process argument and the precedent argument. Does a decision striking down DOMA have legitimacy if DOMA isn't defended? Because our system is built on an adversarial process. And then second, what are people, you know, in this room and in this society, gonna say when President Huckabee decides that he's not gonna defend the Matthew Shepard hate crimes law because he feels it's unconstitutional because it violates due process, right? So there's policy issues here about the implications.
I'll take the first question.
That's where I was going to.
Go for it.
No, it's, and actually, Professor Frost should probably take the first question because she talked about this. But the statute will get a vigorous defense. Congress will step up. Amicus briefs will be coming out of everywhere. So it will be an adversarial proceeding. All the arguments will be here. I think there's no question about that.
And Marbury versus Madison wasn't adversarial.
As for President Huckabee, don't worry about it. He's not going to run.
But I mean, but this is why I think the administration takes so seriously onus of sort of departing from. I mean, there's a stare decisis of that.
There is, and we didn't really talk about it, but it's important to distinguish this situation from the situation where the administration just announces they're not going to enforce the law. I think Professor Frost mentioned that. But that's a much bigger decision still. And that's the one I think that's very dangerous. And of course, we see that frequently when presidents are signing laws. And President Bush, you know, I think, you know, over 1,000 provisions of law announced that there was some part of it that he might not enforce if it was inconsistent with his authority as commander-in-chief or the unitary executive theory or whatever. And of course, the real problem was we never knew what the law was because it was all secret. But this is not as significant a step as that. And in these situations, the statute always gets a defense. I'm confident that would happen under President Huckabee.
Even if it requires appointment of amicus. I mean, this happens actually fairly regularly now when the federal government refuses to defend the decision below in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court appoints an amicus. Indeed, one of our newest colleagues was a court-appointed amicus in the Supreme Court case. So, yeah.
Which, by the way, a hard position to take. You're getting up there because no one else. No,
but as a result, the justices are a lot nicer.
They are.
They're a lot nicer.
They thank
you for your service. Hey, I don't need this. I'm out.
So we haven't quite gotten to this in con law.
Who's your con law professor?
But, I mean, so correct any of my understanding if they're wrong, but how could we get to a heightened scrutiny level? How can we get to strict scrutiny? Because I believe it's about, can you argue that marriage is a fundamental right? Can you argue that, people with sexual minorities, gays and lesbians are discrete and insular minorities? I mean, how do we get to the heightened scrutiny level? And
there are two different possibilities. I think you just mentioned both of them, right? So this is why Lawrence is problematic, because Justice Kennedy talks about both of them. Not marriage, but sexual autonomy. Right, so Lawrence, Justice Kennedy has, there are two different strands of his opinion. One is that sexual autonomy, he never uses fundamental right in the same sentence, but he uses the words fundamental and right in the same paragraph. It's hilarious. Basically, yeah. Where he's basically trying to say sexual autonomy is really, really important, but we won't call it a fundamental right. And discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is really, really problematic, but it's not quite, a suspect class warranting heightened scrutiny. I mean, that's exactly why Lawrence has left lower courts in a bit of a lurch, because it has elements of both and yet commits to neither. So I think you could go either way, right? One is to say this is decisional autonomy, right? But then that begs the question, so then what does that mean for other marriage issues, right? Can you marry your first cousin? Can you marry three times without getting divorced, right? I mean, I think
three spouses at once.
It might be a less disruptive tack to take and more about the discrimination and not the institution of marriage to go through the class idea of it versus the right idea of it.
I agree with that. I think if we get to heightened scrutiny, it'll be on the classification being a suspect classification.
And I'll just add to that. All we're talking about is Justice Kennedy.
That's right.
Just as in so many of these cases, but we're talking about whether Justice Kennedy is going to get to heightened scrutiny.
Well, and if we make assumptions that I think are almost certainly correct about Justices Sotomayor and Kagan.
And Roberts,
yes,
and Alito.
I'm willing to make all those assumptions are pretty firm.
I would say three of the four are pretty firm. There's one I'm less sure about. Jason.
I wanted to go back to the letter and the idea that everything's pointing to the president. And everything in the letter is the president told me to do this, the president thinks that, the president this. To what extent are we talking about the president, the person holding the office, and the branch of government, the executive branch of government? And to what extent do we separate the judicial branch of government from the political branches in this issue? And to the idea that the executive, a little bit of what Professor Vladek was saying, kind of created cover for the judicial branches, in that you've got two political branches that may not agree with each other, but now that you at least have one on your side, you're more free to not go against the political branches as a judge.
I mean, I think what's interesting is we see very clearly here that when in all of these cases, in all the cases in which the executive branch participates, it stands up and says, here I am arguing for the United States. I'm submitting a brief on behalf of the United States. But as your question suggests, and as this particular situation points out, they are not representing, those lawyers in the Department of Justice do not represent the entire United States government. They represent the executive branch. And in every case in which, I mean, they would claim, if the Solicitor General is here, they say they keep in mind the interests of the other branches, et cetera. But as others on this panel have mentioned, the Solicitor General and the Attorney General are political appointees answerable directly to the president. Whatever views you have on the unitary executive, I think all reasonable people agree they're answerable to the president. And while the Solicitor General's office has prided itself on having some autonomy and push back and arguing to preserve its credibility before the court by not making overtly political arguments, by adhering to stare decisis, nonetheless, at the end of the day, we would be fooling ourselves, I think, to view the arguments by the United States, by DOJ lawyers, as anything but arguments for the executive branch and the president. And I think you just made a nice comment there at the end about, it does give the court some political cover, but they certainly will hear from other political actors, like Congress, and the court will become the place in which there's a little bit of a showdown, right, between a Republican House and a Democratic President.
And I have one interest. I was just going to add something. But it's a little off point. But one thing we haven't commented at all is, which is amazing to me, is that the president and the attorney general haven't gotten more political heat on this from the right.
What kind of TV do you watch?
Maybe they're so busy trying to decimate the budget and social programs that they aren't interested in this anymore, but it's stunning. Okay.
Well, just 20 seconds. Part of the reason is, it's the political situation we're in. The Tea Party doesn't want to get involved in social issues at this point. Republican leadership is committed to talking only about the deficit. Nobody wants to get distracted into a debate on same-sex marriage.
Which may well have factored into the timing.
Yes.
Last question in the back.
Actually, I thought Newt Gingrich was like, the president should be impeached for this.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a federalism question, I think, that's not necessarily in this section three, which is, but the whole federal government defining marriage in the Defense of Marriage Act versus, of course, the state right to define marriage as part of their state powers. And so it seems there's actually the one way that certain sides might want to go on, like Perry versus Schwarzenegger, seem to be different from the way that the same political argument would argue in a case of the Defense of Marriage Act. I guess it doesn't apply as much to this particular article, but.
So there was a really interesting law review article written a few years ago about the entire history of proposed constitutional amendments to define marriage in one way or another in the federal constitution over our entire history. As you know, none of them have passed. In fact, you probably didn't even know there were so many. And there was an attempt to have a federal marriage amendment. It also didn't go anywhere. I don't think anybody thinks it's going anywhere. I mean, the understanding that the definition of marriage lies with the states has withstood centuries of Sturm und Drang about, the decline of the family and, all sorts of terrible things that would happen if you allowed certain people to marry each other or divorce each other or whatever. I think that's why the gay rights groups brought a Section 3 challenge, not a challenge to, in general, the federal constitutionality of banning same-sex marriage. The cases that this actually affects, the specific cases, are a very narrow issue. They're saying, we've always let states define marriage. The federal government has always considered married people who are married by their states, and there's no reason to depart from that's constitutionally valid just for same-sex couples. And that is a very narrow challenge. It may have larger implications because I think once there's federal recognition of same-sex marriage, there will be some more impetus for some couples to marry in order to get that. And so I'm not saying it wouldn't have a larger implication in the culture, but it doesn't actually mean that a ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. All it means is if you're married in your state, the federal government can't unmarry you because they don't do that for anybody else who's married under state law. We have places where half the states allow first cousins to marry and the other half doesn't. If you live in one of those states and you're married to your first cousin, the federal government thinks you're married. If you live someplace where you can't get married to your first cousin, then you're not married under federal law. I mean, there's just an accommodation of the states, and that's all this particular litigation is about, which to me is part of what makes it so striking that that Obama or the Justice Department or whoever is behind it decided to go out on what looks like this gigantic limb about this grand pronouncement about sexual orientation being entitled to heightened scrutiny when the litigation itself is only about whether the federal government must recognize same-sex couples who are married in their states and not about whether any other state has to recognize same-sex couples as married or let them marry. I mean, to me, that was the astonishing thing about this action, that it seemed out of proportion to what was required to deal with very carefully crafted litigation designed only to do a very specific thing about federalism.
I also suspect, and this is one last thought, I think, Dan, but when you mentioned that, right, the Second Circuit, maybe Nancy mentioned, right, that the Second Circuit hasn't yet ruled on this issue, I don't think it's a coincidence that although the Second Circuit is rather conservative on some issues, it is hardly one of the more socially conservative appellate courts in the country. But we'll see. Well, I hope you will join me in thanking the panel. And stay tuned.